This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on www.prn.fm. This radio presentation replays my weekly TV show, Refounding America with Peter R. Breggin, MD, which can be watched on Brighteon.tv, and it's available on Roku. I interview guests who are heroes and pioneers in confronting the global predators who are behind COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccines, corrupt public health and medicine, global warming, the Great Reset, and other justifications for destroying the Western democracies. They are stealing our countries, our freedoms, our dignity and hope, and our jobs and our savings. For documentation of this worldwide tragedy, read our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, by Peter and Ginger Breggin. Together, my guests and I explore what is happening and what we each can do to refound America and inspire the world. Thank you for your courage in facing these challenges and standing up for liberty. Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. This is Peter R. Breggin, MD, and you are listening or watching Refounding America and Reclaiming Ourselves, the topics of the day for the United States of America and our survival. We are on Brighteon.tv and also on Roku, and you can watch the in-depth interviews that we have, as many of them as you want, on Brighteon.com on the Dr. Peter Breggin channel. Our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, continues to just get a lot of readership. We're up over 100,000 now. Our guest today is Robert Orso, MD. He is one of the brightest, most intelligent, most active, most brilliant people we will have on this show. I really look forward to interviewing him for the first time. Well, let's just dive right in and talk about and with Dr. Richard Orso. Dr. Orso is a partner and an owner in one of the largest medical centers, if not the largest, in Texas. I want him to tell you about that. And I want him to talk about some of his practice. I think he has a surgical cap on. It's not an affectation. The man is actually a surgeon. And he's been strong enough to maintain himself throughout this terrible time of battling. He is a real researcher. He's been in a lab for many, many years. He's done surgery for many, many years. He's an expert on anything to do about really researching drug development, inflammatory processes. He's the inventor of an FDA-approved healing drug. There are so many directions we could go in. Would you like to add anything about your background?
Believer in the Lord.
Well, that's wonderful. Yes, I'll add that to it. And you know, we share something incredible, which is we We both have so much respect and care for Dr. Mingli Yan, Scarlett. I'm very jealous. You see, I don't travel, not because of COVID. My doctor said, if you want to have the longest possible life, stop straining yourself, testifying in court and doing all these crazy things at the age of 81, 2, or 3. So I just stopped traveling, and all of a sudden I was healthier and happier. So it's not because of COVID. And so I'm greatly jealous because you get to travel with Dr. Yan all the time, which is how I met you.
Yes, sir. It's been a lot of fun. A lot of the relationships have really built over the last 2 years. Some wonderful, wonderful people.
I think that that is one of the main things that I try to communicate, usually toward the end of the show, about once you become involved in this high, perhaps high risk behavior of standing up for freedom and doing your best to communicate to people about freedom and its importance and what it means to be a patriotic nation under God and under the Constitution, standing up against this global progressive movement. You start meeting absolutely wonderful people. We have never met so many wonderful people. And here I am now finally talking with you for a period of time.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I found early on. You know, you felt like the Lone Ranger at first. I remember yeah. March 2020. We had a small group that did a lot of talking about drug development and got a call in February. We started talking to people in South Korea and Italy, and it didn't take long to figure out that there was some inflammatory component, there was a respiratory component, there was lots of blood clotting, which is a little different than prior coronaviruses. And then, of course, there was the infectious disease side of it. But all these respiratory viruses were pretty straightforward in the past, and we knew the pathway to replication competency would be about a week. And so we came up with a plan of how to attack it. And when we started, you know, talking about it, got attacked viciously, actually. I talked about using steroids, and people are like, you can't use steroids in a virus. I'm like, oh my God, these people don't practice medicine. Because once we get past the replication cycle, you know, we use steroids all the time. And so it was really a big challenge for me to kind of try to understand what was happening. And felt like a Lone Ranger for a short while, but eventually found Peter McCullough and many others, Robert Malone and Ryan Cole, and they're fantastic people, and so many others. I can't even name them all, but it's just been a wonderful time. Harvey Reich, and we put together a group of people that we come together, and we formed the Global COVID Summit, which is now physicians and scientists. Where we came together to put together a declaration so that we could stand up, so we weren't Lone Rangers. We were pooling our resources and standing up and putting out information that would be helpful to the public, basically helpful to find a way forward. We put out our fourth declaration showing that we have a way forward. Here's our 10 steps to go forward. And that's something we did just last week in response to the government's attempt. Actually, I'll have to tell you this, Peter, it's kind of funny. I don't know if you heard this, but we put together Global COVID Summit last September, and 2 weeks later, they came up with Global COVID-19 Summit in the government. wiped us off of Google. But we had such a big following. We've got 17, almost 18,000 doctors now. And that is from the relationships, all these great people coming together, and we were able to have many others feel strong enough to help fight with us. And so I think that's our goal, is to kind of create that community, create that feeling that we're not alone, that we are standing up for freedom, we are standing up for the Lord, we are standing up for medicine and the way we learn medicine, the way we practice. So there's many, many reasons we need to stand up. And much as it's nice to sit back and not do it, I'm in the position, I'm older, to where I am more established, and I could do that without having to risk my mortgage and everything else.
Yeah, there's many of us who are older like that, but some other men, established people like Peter McCullough, have had to pay a tremendous price. You've had your own corporation, which sounds like it's been a tremendous advantage to you, and you're in Texas too, which apparently is helpful.
Yeah, that, see, I you're right. Peter has been, Peter Corey, they have been, you know, lost jobs. It's unbelievable to me. You know, Peter lost three jobs. He's a fantastic intensive care unit person. Peter, two jobs. He lost, you know, so many of his titles. The most published person on COVID in the United States with 56 papers is Peter McCullough. He outpublished, Peter McCullough has outpublished the entire NIH in the last 2 years. The entire,
I love that.
It's amazing.
Peter, they liberated him. They didn't know what they were doing when they fired him from reviewing other people's papers as the head of journals and so on. They liberated him to do what he does, what he loves to do the most, is write those papers. God bless him.
So true. Always call him the captain, and he's relentless. In fact, that's what he tells me, stay relentless. And I'll tell you, one of the really most beautiful things is spending time with Robert Malone. He's such a kind person. Him and his wife have a fantastic relationship. It's just fantastic people to be around. Ryan Cole has become one of my best friends. And I can't tell you how hard everyone's fighting, how hard everybody's working. But some of them are really getting hit back in many ways, particularly with the lawsuits. They're coming at them with all kinds of lawsuits that is draining their pockets as much as they can. Mm. But we have other people that are stepping up, you know, trying to help them. And so we have a community now. We're not alone.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's a wonderful and beautiful community. At some point I wanted to spend a little time, but I'm just going to make a quick tag about it and then continue to focus on the things you're doing. As everybody probably who follows us knows, we have been focusing tremendously on two developments, disastrous developments with the World Health Organization, both of them led by the United States of America. One is the United States of America putting in changes to the amending the regulations that govern the World Health Organization's activities, and particularly place restraints on the Director General, who right now is a man who is a communist stooge, essentially. Tedros is a Marxist thug. He is so much a supporter of the Chinese communists that they managed to get him approved just now, recently this year, for another 5 years without opposition. The man who's done the most in some ways to cover up the origins in the Wuhan Institute, which were very quickly apparent to anybody who was reading the scientific literature. And so he is going to have unparalleled powers to intervene now if these amendments are passed. There's a big meeting May 22nd through the 28th in Geneva of the World Health Organization. And we've been publicizing this. We're urging everybody to make it a big issue in November. There's a lot of states in this union that will really bridle against enabling the dictator, who's now going to be really like a dictator, to be able to come and declare global health emergencies in any country of his choosing on a whim, and then to bring the full brunt of the power of the UN and a whole bunches of associated groups. And people have been claiming that the Chinese, this is really aimed at the Chinese communists. They haven't even peeped. They're not complaining. They know the World Health Organization isn't going to interfere in their country. They run the World Health Organization, along with Bill Gates. And this is a menace aimed at the United States, who is the center of the opposition to globalism, to the opposition to the patriotic center and heart of the United States of America, because that's what stands up against globalism at the present time and against the extreme forms of progressivism that are closely associated with it. So we're working hard on that. If you want to get our latest information on our website, we've made it especially easy to get there. Go to 123newsflash.com. 123newsflash.com, And you'll see our latest three articles. They're full of links that will take you into a deeper understanding of this. And then secondly, also on 123newsflash.com is our discussion of a second goal, which is the treaties. They want to make treaties that will make Tedros the center of all global health control, authority, and arranging. He has been very definitive about this. It's very clear. And there are many, many nations, perhaps the entire EU and maybe Great Britain and Canada and Australia too, who might sign those treaties. They are supporting the idea. The US is supporting the idea. We have to win the November election so that the Senate can prevent these treaties. But even if we could prevent the treaties temporarily, many other countries would take them and agree to become this deep part of the communist UN globalist movement. And that, folks, would present us with a terrible block against freedom. So that's all I'm going to say about it today, because we have so much to talk with Dr. Orso about.
Can I tag in on that a little bit?
Oh, I'd love you to tag in.
Sometimes I wonder if people recognize how powerful that statement was you just made. I mean, these things are, Tedros should not have this much power. He's not an elected official. He's not even a scientist. So, you know, it's the process that we're going through to put these people into power takes away our civil liberties. It takes away our freedom to think as scientists ourselves. And what we've seen, and I want to tag on to that, because we're basically going to put ourselves in the hands of, we've never put ourselves in the hands of the FDA, the NIH, or the CDC. Why is that? They've never practiced medicine, neither has the WHO. They've never practiced medicine, they never see patients, okay? So they their stated mission is not patient care. So why would we call them in the middle of the pandemic to tell us how to practice medicine? It's absolutely absurd. So they, you know, we learn how to do that in medical school, and so you're asking these agencies as if they have all of a sudden special powers somewhere. They gain special powers to know how to treat patients out of nowhere. I mean, that's not what they do. That's not the structure the organization was ever meant to do. They're, you know, data analyzers. That's what they should be doing. And of course, their data is corrupted. You know, I mean, you've seen that time and time again through this past pandemic, a lot of corrupted data. And the data we don't have that's corrupted is getting shut down. Like we just found, I want to point it out because for people who don't know, I think it's really important. How corrupted is the system? Harvard and Lancet put together a completely fabricated study on hydroxychloroquine. And so people don't know, Harvard and Lancet, medical Bible, one of the medical Bibles. That's just one idea of part of the overall corruption that's occurring. It's occurring at many levels, including the universities and including in the major journals that we go to. And now you're going to expect people who are bureaucrats to actually practice medicine. That's absurd. So we need to fight this really hard. You said it so well. I almost wish I'd tape it and put it out somewhere else. And I also heard you say about the treaties. And clearly, this you know, anybody who grew up in this country, and my age, and I'm 63, is basically would be could never believe that other people from other countries would come into our country and tell us what to do, how to manage things. First of all, as I just pointed out, they have no business doing it because they don't have the expertise. Second of all, you know, it's a free, you know, our country is our own country. Expertise needs to come from within this country. Globalism is real, and we are, as you said, the main buttress against globalism taking over the entire world. You saw that during the pandemic. I think anybody who's in politics could figure out that they've already got, as you said, why wouldn't they be able to manage this treaty with all the young global leaders they have, and Canada, Macron, you know, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of Austria, Australia, New Zealand. They've already trained all these people.
That's right.
So they're like a net, it's like a spider web, and they're everywhere. And it's up to us to kind of stand up and say, hey, that's not going to work for us. This is not your planet. This is our planet.
Oh, I love that. I remember one of my colleagues reminding me about the all these alphabet agencies, that we went through medical school without taking any information from directly from the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, the NIMH. All that stuff was foreign. I spent 2 years as a lieutenant commander and a full-time consultant at the National Institute of Mental Health. That was my first exposure to anything like that. And I just happened to ended up becoming a medical expert, with issues involving some of these companies, these agencies over the years. But they didn't teach us medicine. We never had a speaker from the CDC or the FDA or any of these places, folks. They had nothing to do with us. We were trained to be doctors.
Nothing. And I was actually a little bit surprised at how much the drift had occurred. I left the university system in 2005, but I stayed training fellows for about another 6 years. I was really surprised to see this happen. I didn't see it coming, as well as some other people did. The pharmaceutical companies have their teeth everywhere. I think you know that. That's another. The corporate pharmaceutical companies are into medical education. They basically are major players in the journals, and so the corruption really starts in that at that level. And they are the major funders to the CDC, the NIH, and the FDA. So, we've got a lot to do. I think from my standpoint, I've always been somebody to kind of try to make sure we have data and truth coming and that's the main thing I think that we've done is to try to give people another view on what the data really is. And that's been something, Peter's been great with that. McCullough's amazing. But we've all taken that on and we've all kind of come as best we can. Like for me, looking at the drug design stuff, I always joke about the fact that molnupiravir and remdesivir, two old nucleoside analog cancer drugs, they're nothing special. We look at, Paxlovid, is Kalitra 2.0. It's an old protease inhibitor that they slightly changed in order to make it a patentable thing. So anybody who thinks that the pharmaceutical industry is making wonderful things, they're not ingenious at all. Now, the drug I worked on, nerve growth factor, I found that it helped. Found some nerve growth factor receptors on some cells back in the early 90s, and then figured out that it had something to do with epithelial cell migration. A completely novel idea, and ended up. It's now approved for use, but it took many years, over 20 years. Peter Cook patented to getting on the market. These guys are putting out stuff with no testing. They put out this messenger RNA lipid nanoparticle product in a matter of months. And everyone who worked with a lipid nanoparticle knows that they go everywhere. You cannot control a lipid nanoparticle. So I was upset with the fact they were going that technology back in 2020, because I already know with the cancer chemotherapy things that we were doing, we were getting the cancer chemotherapy, trying to get it to the brain, because lipid nanoparticles are fantastic at getting to the brain. That unfortunately was going to bone marrow, adrenals, ovaries, et cetera. It was going to places we didn't want it to go. So it's pretty much been abandoned as a chemo carrier. But one of its beauties of lipid nanoparticles is access to the brain. Why would you want to make foreign proteins in a brain? No vaccines ever in the past history have ever gone to the brain to make foreign proteins ever in existence. It's the first time. Mm-hmm. And they avoided that, mentioning that the whole time. You could shout it to the rafters and nobody was listening.
And they were planning that, folks, probably between 6 and 10 years ago, before COVID started. So it's more longer ago than that. And they already knew that they'd never been successful working with this whole design. They knew that. They created a company, Moderna, to become the first vaccine company to do this, and it never had any products. Its first products were the vaccines that American humans are taking. They were working with Pfizer way back, and the wealthy people of the world knew that this is where the direction was going with the pharmaceutical industry and Bill Gates, and they were priming up to make a ton of money with the next assault from that they could call an epidemic or a pandemic. This thing could have been seriously controlled by the existing medications we had. This is the story of COVID-19, the global predators that my wife and I tell. We've got about just about 35 seconds left. I want to get into the most interesting topics, all lined up by Dr. Urso and not by me, in the next segment. I think this lipid nanoparticle, I mean, you've already said things that are amazing about it. I want you to talk about all the stuff you're doing when we come back. And it's just a pleasure to be getting to know you. This is my face-to-face life now, and that I don't travel. Well, we're back with amazing physician Richard Urso, a very remarkable man. And I'm going to just kind of sit back and listen to and be taught for the next section here, our part two. And Dr. Urso would like to talk some more about the lipid nanoparticle. And it's been a subject of so much discussion. I think he's going to make it clear to all of us what it's all about. Sir, take over.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan. Well, I think people need to hear a couple of things. Number one, this lipid nanoparticle messenger RNA platform is always going to have troubles because of the distribution. The lipid nanoparticle is always going to go to, like I said before, the brain, bone marrow, the adrenals, the ovaries. That's one big thing that has to be, everyone needs to know. You cannot make foreign proteins into those tissues and not expect something bad to happen. So this is a really bad platform that they push forward. As Dr. Bregan said earlier, it was a failed platform up until about 2017, and then they started thinking about the vaccine really in a big way, and that was they pushed this ahead of every other technology for a reason. What I always tell people is it's like the nuclear bomb technology in a sense. This is a very powerful technology. It's a gene editing technology, and in a sense, like nuclear energy, you could potentially make electricity with nuclear energy, or you can make a nuclear bomb. And the problem with the gene editing technology, it's very similar in that you can make many different things, many different proteins. Some of those can be very destructive. And so I consider it not a great platform. But especially as a foreign protein platform for a vaccine, you're making those proteins in areas you never want to make vaccines, ovaries, brain. It's just not a smart technology for that. All right, so that's number one, the biodistribution. Number two, we've seen that the spike protein in this case is getting into the nucleus, and it's causing disruption of the DNA repair mechanisms. What does that mean? P53, BRCA, and an uptick in microRNA 27A is basically going to cause an uptick in cancers, and that's what we're seeing. So biodistribution problem, number two, uptick in cancers. Number three, we're seeing a disruption of toll-like receptors 7 and 8. What that means is you're going to have a lot more difficulty with viral immune surveillance, more Bell's palsy. You're going to have more Epstein-Barr, herpes simplex, herpes zoster. All the herpes viruses that lay dormant in the body are going to basically be hard to control. And you're seeing that, and I'm seeing it in my clinic. We saw a doubling of our zoster and our Epstein, our Bell's palsies last year in our clinic. We had 300,000 patients coming through. It was almost doubled last year. And as people know, forget about that. The actuaries have told us that the ages of 18 to 64 is now 40% rise in deaths last year. What do you attribute to that? That's a big thing, and everyone needs to understand people are dying from these vaccines. And they're dying of heart attacks, they're dying of strokes, they're dying of pulmonary embolus. I had a 37-year-old in my clinic 2 days ago with a pulmonary embolus. And he was like, just we sent him to the ER, he had a pulmonary embolus. Young, marine, healthy. No reason. He just had the booster 10 days ago. So we're seeing these things, and that's not the only. We're seeing that it's going into the arm and then ending up in the lymph node, and we're producing spike protein in the germinal centers there for up to 60 days. We don't know if it's longer because that's when they stop testing. That's called pharmacokinetics. The pharmacokinetics were thought to be going to be producing spike for about a couple hours maybe. Now we're finding out we're producing it for 60 days or more. Think about that. What that means is these poor people are making more spike protein than if they ever got the actual virus itself. So you're getting more and more and more things that just don't make sense. Now, on top of that, when you get the third jab, there's something called antibody-dependent cytotoxicity that occurs. So in your first and second jab, you're getting a lot of your innate immune response and your antibody response. Once your body starts realizing that there's a problem, that it can't put out the fire, basically, and this thing's going to keep popping up, it starts ramping up to first, second, third, and fourth gear. So you're getting into that innate adaptive response with the antibodies. And then you kind of, when the antibodies aren't really working, you get into cytotoxic T lymphocytes. You get into natural killer cells. The complement system comes in and does its thing. So basically, you're getting attacks from multiple systems. Your whole immune system is being trained to fight something really small. And you don't have, this is not an infinite immune system. You don't have an infinite number of T lymphocytes and things. So you are basically training an entire army to fight one thing. And that means you can't fight other things. So you're, as I'll run through them again one more time, if you don't mind, Peter.
Oh, it's great what you're doing.
Biodistribution, problem there. Uptick in cancers, viral immune surveillance, number three. Number four, 40% increase in deaths. Number five, 60 days or more of production of the spike protein. Number six, antibody-dependent cytotoxicity, where you see an uptick in cytotoxic T lymphocytes. You see an uptick in complement attacks, and you see an uptick in natural killer cells attacks. So this is basically why a lot of people are having problems. You're training the system the wrong way, and we continue down this path. The stuff that Garrett VandenBosch just talked about is going to partially come true, particularly for the vaccinated whose immune systems will be wrecked by this product. So that's kind of a rough idea of what I wanted everybody to hear. I think it's real important, and I think if you take anything from what I say, I think that's a really important thing to take home. This platform is a bad platform.
One of the analogies that comes to my mind is when I try to tell people that one of the basic problems with psychiatric drugs is the body treats them as enemies, and it does everything in its power to overcome the suppressive interfering effects of the psychiatric drugs. It attacks them. And you're describing something much more global, and which is the body is fighting against all these massive intrusions with the injections. And the body's fight is itself very destructive and reaches these tremendous inflammatory levels. Is that a reasonable summary?
That's exactly what's happening. As you go through the boosters, you're getting a step up in the thing. Once your body doesn't, once the first thing doesn't work, your body tries to come to the next level and next level and next level. Now you've got the entire immune system being trained just to fight one thing. And it's basically going to create a system that is going to be very susceptible to other things because you have fighters that are only trained in one direction. And that's what's happening. We're seeing it. You know, as people who haven't heard, I'm going to give you two facts that are from England. 92% of the deaths in March were in the triple vaccinated, 92%. Of the ages from 10 to 14, I mean, this number is almost unbelievable that I even when I say it, I almost don't believe it. 10 to 14, all-cause mortality. They could have died from getting hit by a car, but the all-cause mortality in people who are vaccinated, 10 to 14, is 52 times higher than the unvaccinated children. That's England. That's the English data. That was so profound.
That's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. And what they did, Peter, was they actually decided not to publish any more of their data. So we don't have the April data because they'd stop publishing it because it was 92% and 52 times more. And all of us were going around showing that data. That was our last place where we didn't have corrupted data. For people who don't know, the CDC stopped tracking data in May of 20, a year ago, basically. And they basically don't have... If they do have the data, they're not saying they have the data. So they stop tracking data, stop announcing the data like England was doing up until end of March.
So how accurate are the recent data that there are, like, you know, we're approaching 30,000 reported deaths in the U.S., at least reported from more places in the U.S., mostly the U.S., to our CDC system, the VAERS system, is that data itself corrupted?
So I'm gonna say no, in a sense. The VAERS data, in this sense, the VAERS data is time consuming. Nobody goes in there and puts fake data into VAERS. I don't know. I've never heard of it. It's never been.
Yeah, that's my impression too. They want to ignore it. They're just trying desperately to ignore these catastrophic numbers. Because, folks, if you have 30,000 reports of death from something, from anything in these systems, it represents at the least 10 times as many actual events or deaths. And it could be 100 times as many. And given the fact that no doctor wants to lay his hands on any of this and get involved reporting things, they don't want his nurses or his aides reporting things because they get in trouble for it. So the 30,000 could be easily 300,000, and it could be mega factors past that. We're getting this sense. I mean, I hadn't heard this figure before. I mean, Dr. Urso's saying more than 50% increase.
52 times.
Yeah.
52 times. It's amazing.
Oh, 52 times. Oh, my God.
It's crazy. It's a crazy number.
Oh, it's hard to grasp. Yeah. 52 times. I repeat it. Say it again.
I'm reluctantly saying it. I wish it weren't true.
And I twisted it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's not my data. So the other thing I think is so amazing is when you just look at the comments that were done. They did a global COVID-19 summit in Washington, and the comments, the vernacular, we have to get more jabs in arms. Doctors don't talk that way, especially about patients. That's like you're talking about a thing, and so we just don't use that terminology. The empathy and the professionalism. I don't know what happened. It's shocking.
It's awful what's happened in our profession. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's really a sad thing. But I think people need to hear these numbers. It's really important. I just keep bringing up, hey, 40% more deaths in 2021. What was different? And there's nothing different. The actuaries found they were having lots more heart attacks, lots more cancer deaths, lots more strokes, lots more pulmonary embolus. Those vascular especially were incredibly uptick. We saw them in ocular literature. We had them. So I mean, we just saw a lot more injury and a lot more death. And the VAERS reports, we always say, well, they're much higher. We don't have to even talk about the VAERS reports. We have a 40% higher death rate in 18 to 64 people who don't expect to die. And that has to be explained somehow. The vaccine is the reason. The gene editing technology is the reason, because of all the problems with vascular disease. That's the main reason.
Yeah,
I've had talks about with Peter McCullough too about the heart injury, and I have it pretty much. I'll say it on the show if you want to hear it, because I think this is interesting. I don't know if Peter's talked about myocarditis or not, but so my background, like I said, is inflammation, and there's a cell line that I call the pericyte, which lines the outer wall of the vessels, and it's a cell line. It's mesenchymal cell line is similar to the fibroblasts that I work with so long. So I was very interested in that. So, and as people know, in kids, the myocarditis has been really high. So the mechanism, all right, and this is my thoughts on the mechanism, is that lipid nanoparticles need a door crack, and a virus needs an open door. So lipid nanoparticles slip through tight junctions like in the brain, and the heart has tight junctions. So what's happening, these kids, they with exercise, they have this beating heart, and the tight junctions loosen with exercise. So we're seeing lipid nanoparticles slip through. The virus can't slip through, but a lipid nanoparticle can. And it's getting through to the pericytes. Guess what has a ton of ACE2 receptors? Pericytes. So they lock on there, and they basically create an inflammatory cascade, which releases a bunch of spike protein, which then distributes. And if you look at the injuries, they're saying it's a catecholamine response. The very diffuse injury is because the spike is perfect fit through gap junctions, and you get a very diffuse release of spike protein through the entire heart. And I think that's the major mechanism of the myocarditis. So I talked a couple of times with Peter. I gave a talk one time, and I said, Peter McCullough is here in the front row, and I'm going to tell you the mechanism. And I said, I'm going to look at Peter, see if he's shaking his head like this, or if he's doing like this. And Peter was going, I said, okay.
It's so interesting. Every time I'd have a complex part of the book when I was writing COVID-19 and the global predators, I'd just send a question to Peter McCullough. And sometimes you actually write back a paragraph and I just put it in the book, as Peter McCullough says.
I believe it. And you know, well, he's so data driven, so you don't have to worry. He never says things that he hasn't backed up, because he knows we have a responsibility to do that for our patients. So when we say something, we cannot, when people ask me my opinion, I say, it's not good for me to have an opinion. I go, it's very important that I have an opinion, but it's not important. What's important is, what does the data say? And that's what I really try to stick to over and over. It's really important. If it says 52 times more people are dying in 10 to 14 given a vaccine, I have to have an explanation for that. I don't know the explanation. I think it's, you know, clearly the vaccine has a big role. And when somebody says, hey, it's going into the ovaries, what's going to happen to fertility? And I say, I don't know. I know inflammation is not going to be good for fertility. I don't know that it's going to actually cause a decrease in the birth rate, but it certainly scares me. And I definitely tell my children, my girls, to not get that vaccine, because you're going to get inflammation for sure. There's lots of ACE2 receptors in the ovaries, so don't do it. I don't have the data to say you're going to not be able to have babies, but I'm certainly concerned about it. And concerned enough as a researcher that I would say, I'm not going to take that chance until I understand that a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the subjects that you hold dear, I'm sure, we talked about it a little bit earlier before we got on the air, is what's happening to the patient-physician relationship. And it's interesting, COVID-19 has made me feel more and more like a physician. I used to think mainly of myself as a psychiatrist and often as a psychologist, because psychiatrists doing such bad things, I think, well, all right, I'm also a psychologist. I know about psychology and therapy and helping people. But I've become so acutely aware of being a physician and the disaster for the patient-physician relationships. And I know it personally, because when I go to doctors here in Ithaca, New York, if I take Ginger's mom, or I go by myself, or I accompany Ginger to a doctor, there are now areas where, even though I'm a physician, if I so much as show an interest in, I get a nasty response from seemingly lovely human beings, and something dreadful, like a spike protein, has been, you know, changing the personality of these people. And I think it's fear. But how does that work for you? You own a large health delivery system. Are you able to keep your doctors treating patients with love, treating them as treasures rather than as, you know, hindquarters or arms to be jabbed?
It's so well said. I think you and I may have talked about it a few minutes before we started, but it's the patients are so kind right now. That are coming in, they know I'm treating a lot of people with COVID. I've treated over 1,800 people with COVID. I'm treating a tremendous number of COVID injured patients. What I'm seeing, though, in some places in the hospitals here, I've never seen before. And you cannot talk about these things, like you said, without the fear of losing their job, the fear of not being part of the system in some way scares some people so much. They're not willing to look at the data. So the fear is the thing. And I told one of my patients today, I have great conversations with engineers. They're such critical thinkers. They can't help themselves. You can tell them something, but they have to know a little bit more. I was talking to one. I said, you know, women with higher cholesterol outlive women with lower cholesterol. And she's like, well, where's the paper? And I go, I'll show you the landmark first one, and there's about eight more. So welcome. I'll start you off, and let's go on your way. They're interested in hearing about it. Their curiosity is there. And I think the fear is the thing, Peter, because the curiosity was always there for me and many other of my colleagues. And I think the fear has created this, let me put my head in the sand. And it's almost like you're stuck in a Stockholm syndrome after a while. And believe that you were doing something wrong is so bad. I mean, you know, to say that you let a lot of people go home without treatment, now what are you going to do? You know, and I always tell them, like, why would you not use on-label drugs for inflammation when there's an inflammatory response like prednisone? Why would you not use respiratory drugs, that budesonide and other things for respiratory problems, why would you not use blood clotting prevention like Eliquis, aspirin, Xarelto when people have prone to blood clotting from this disease? That's all on label. There's nothing off label about that. The only thing off label is the biologically plausible mechanisms that we can find to fight the viruses, including protease inhibitors, nucleoside analogs, hydroxychloroquine, chloroquine, cyclosporin, ivermectin, colchicine. So there's a whole list. I found about 9 of them in about 2 hours in early March. I said, let's find everything that might work. And what I find so crazy is that early in the pandemic, people were still open-minded, but they were fearful in Texas. Let me tell you what happened here, Peter, because I think this is very interesting. They actually told us that if we wore PPE and wasted it, we could have a criminal charge. That put fear in me a little bit. I was like, oh my God, if I waste PPE, if I get accused of wasting PPE in my clinic and it's not being used in the hospital, I could actually end up in jail. I mean, I was literally sent out a letter to that.
Tell people what PPE is.
Personal protective equipment, it's mask, hat, you know, the gowns, all the things with gloves. So if we use that equipment in our office when they need it at the hospital, so we were like, what, that's crazy. Like a lot of my partners said, I'm just going home. I don't want to know about it. And I just said, I'm not going home. I'm a doctor. I'm treating patients. I don't care. And so I started calling my patients, telling them, hey, if nobody will help you, go and talk to your doctor. If no one will help you, I will help you.
Wow.
And now it's 1,800 plus patients, almost 19 now.
If no one will help you, I will help you. I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. This has been an absolutely wonderful time together, listening to you and talking with you. You exemplify everything that's good about being a healer and being a physician, being a researcher. And it makes this work worthwhile, folks, to get to work with wonderful people, wonderful human beings. It's funny you mentioned engineers. My wife thinks of herself, Ginger, as an engineer. Her dad was an engineer. And she actually is, you know, she's the one who fixes anything around the house. She won't let me touch the thing. And that's a part. Well, you know, she just gets to the bottom. She wants to know the facts and she gets to the bottom of stuff. And so we do all that wonderful research together. Oh, gosh. And yeah, we have only 20 seconds left. A benediction, anything you'd like to do.
I just want to thank you so much. I look forward to working with you in the future. I know we're going to do some great things and we're going to turn this around. God's on our side.
God's on our side. He's on all of our sides. Do not be embarrassed to turn to God for protection and sustenance. We all need.